This will be the next installment of our Science Progress interview series, and today we're speaking with Nancy B. Spinner, who is at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in the Genetics and Gene Regulation Program. Thanks for joining us, Professor Spinner.
Nice to be here.
Okay, great. Well, today I just wanted to talk a little bit about your research and some of the new advances that are happening on the frontiers of genetics. The latest sequencing tools for genetics research are actually revealing huge stores of information that go beyond identifying just the function of individual genes. And instead, there are significant patterns in the copies of genes distributed across a person's DNA and across a population. This is referred to as copy number variation. Can you explain this type of research and how it changes the way scientists are approaching genetics?
Sure. So first, let me say that my work actually straddles the borderland between diagnosis and research, mm-hmm. because I both run a clinical diagnostic laboratory and I run a research laboratory. Mm-hmm. So some of what I have to say may apply to one or the other. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of huge advances in our field. It's been a seminal time for us in that the human genome sequence is known. That's the first draft of that was deposited in 2001. And we have known since around that time that there are differences from person to person. This is not unexpected because we all vary. We're all identifiable, and so our sequence reflects that, although it's actually a relatively small portion of our genomes that vary by single base changes, and we've understood that. But starting in 2004, we realized that we all vary not only in those single nucleotide changes, but that there are larger regions that can be deleted or we can have an extra copy of that are present in normal people. And this was really mind-boggling because we've known for many years, since the late 1950s, early 1960s, that there are some people with abnormalities or diseases, as we know them, for example, Down syndrome, where there is a whole extra copy of a chromosome, chromosome 21 in that case, and that causes a disease, which is Down syndrome and is pretty reproducible. And since that time, there have been many, many, many examples where missing something or having something extra causes a disease that you can understand and study. But now we have the tools to look at small pieces. When we look at whole chromosomes or parts of chromosomes, we're looking at millions and millions of base pairs. But the new technology allows us to look at smaller regions. And now we are using this in two ways. My lab's so excited because we can identify smaller deletions or duplications that cause disease, but at the same time, we're finding very small and sometimes not that small deletions and duplications in normal people. So now our challenge is to be able to figure out which things are normal and which things are not normal, and what are the functions of these normal variations? How do they impact the differences between us in terms of, maybe in terms of normal variation in humans, you know, with respect to skills or height or, you know, eye color or hair color, all the ways that we vary, and do they cause us to have underlying susceptibilities to disease? Huge area right now.
Certainly. You'd mentioned Down syndrome in particular. Are there other types of diseases that your lab is focusing on in your research?
Well, from the perspective, our research isn't really focused on Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. In the clinical lab, we diagnose many, many different types of abnormalities that are caused by whole chromosomes being extra, like Down syndrome, trisomy 18, trisomy 13. There's a whole range of syndromes caused by deletions of a part of the genome. My lab in particular has focused on a disease called Alagille syndrome, which is a dominant disease that can sometimes be caused by deletion of a part of chromosome 20. And we've been studying this disease actually for 15 years now. And we were able to identify what the gene is that causes it, and we've been studying that gene. But again, this is one of a number of different disorders caused by loss of something within the genome.
Hmm. Going back to what you remarked on a moment ago, sort of the difference between normal and abnormal genes, some of this research over the past few years has also revealed that there's a huge amount of junk DNA in our chromosomes, and you were talking about the difference between normal genes and abnormal genes. Can you talk a little bit more about the amount of information that's in our DNA that may not necessarily be relevant to who we are?
Sure. Well, I won't say anything's not relevant, because
right.
this is, of course, we those of us who are geneticists now, this is what we're addressing.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there are 3 × 10⁹ base pairs of DNA. That's a lot of DNA that codes for about 30,000 genes. Overall, maybe 5% of all of that DNA actually codes for the genes. And when I say the genes, I'm usually we're referring to a piece of DNA that codes for a product, usually a protein product.
Mm-hmm.
So there's much of the genome that we're not completely sure what it does, but there have been a number of large studies. Now that we know pretty much the whole sequence, we can look at variation, both in the part of the genome that is known to code for genes and the stuff that isn't known to code for genes, and we're starting to learn about what's in all of that stuff that we just didn't recognize before. So there is a project, an ongoing project from the National Human Genome Research Institute called the ENCODE Project, or Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. And this is a consortium that is setting out to try to figure out what are all the parts of the genome that are really crucial that we just didn't recognize before. We've gotten good at recognizing a gene. We know what its architecture looks like, and we can pretty much identify it rather in a straightforward fashion, but we don't know about all of the other parts of the genome, and we're just starting to learn about those.
Interesting. Now, there's been a lot of coverage in the mainstream press recently about policy issues related to genetic privacy or the potential for people learning more about their genomes and being subject to genetic discrimination based on predispositions that they might have. Does this new information that's coming out of studies of copy number variation have implications for these policy discussions?
I think it has implications, and I think there is so much to learn that it's really almost, in a way, mind-boggling. Luckily, the threats of genetic discrimination really haven't been borne out in too many cases. So the genetics community is happy to see that that really hasn't been as much of a problem as I think people were worried about in the beginning. And you can see the problems that are now facing us are that we are just at the very, very beginning of A, understanding the variation in the genome, and B, understanding how it relates to health and disease. So it is all so new that it is very difficult. The science is just not there yet to be able to tell us what it means when you have something that's extra or missing. And I'll give you an example. We are now launching looking at these very small deletions and duplications as a clinical diagnostic test. There are many labs that are already doing it. My lab is starting. We are actually planning for a May 1st to start opening the door to take in these tests. And we can now look at very small deletions or duplications. So many researchers have been applying this to lots of different populations. So, for example, there was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine on duplications and deletions of a small part of chromosome 16 that may be associated with autism. This is one study. I don't think the data is convincing, but it is a published study in the New England Journal of Medicine. As we start running these tests clinically, we recently studied a patient. It was a research sample, and the sample was being done because the child had died of multiple congenital anomalies before birth. So this was a serious, severe kind of an abnormality. We looked at the parent's DNA, and in fact, the mother carries this duplication. So the literature in 2007, I think the paper, or it may have been early 2008, there's a paper saying these same duplications can be associated with autism, but yet I have now a family where a child had a totally different problem, had this same duplication, and the mother carries it. So from my perspective, I'm very nervous. I don't want to overstate this relationship. I'm not convinced of it, but it's one report in a prominent journal. Anyone who Googles this will find this paper. So I think this is just one example and shows you what happens. This is a brand new tool. This work is so new that the scientific community hasn't really had a chance to digest it yet. So we're very, very excited about these new tools for diagnostics because in many cases we're finding things we never could have seen before. The number of abnormalities that I'm convinced of has more than doubled with this new technology. So the number of patients we'll be able to find diagnoses for and explain what's happening and give them accurate recurrence risks is wonderful, but yet we don't understand the information yet.
Interesting. Well, so let me back up, since we need to expand our understanding of all this. How important is government support of this basic research in genetics? And is it, should we think of this in terms of possibilities for creating treatment breakthroughs, or is that short-sighted?
Well, of course, you're asking a scientist, so I have to say that most of our work is funded by the National Institutes of Health. Mm-hmm. And as you can see, just from what I've told you, and one of the reasons I love what I do is that I do sit at the, I sit at this boundary of, I use basic science information all the time. I do a diagnostic test, and a lot of my research tends to be translational in nature. So I'm really sitting on the fence between the clinical end and the basic science end. And you absolutely have to have all of those pieces in place. There's absolutely no question about it. The basic scientists who work in model organisms like yeast or Drosophila or the mouse, they can really do experiments to try to understand. Once somebody like myself identifies a gene that's important in a human disease or a region of the genome, the only way to really study it is in a model organism. So you have to have all of those tools set up and in place to do that kind of very basic science work. And I think that in the human genetics world, there have been some recent advances in a couple of different diseases, for example, Marfan syndrome and Fragile X syndrome, where the information that we're getting is starting to be used for treatment. So I think it's a really exciting time with a lot of possibilities. And as a scientist, I think it's crucial that we fund, you have to fund the people who are doing the health-related research so that they can identify the problems, and you have to fund the basic scientists.
I that all makes good sense. Well, is there anything else that we ought to close on that you'd like to add for our listening audience?
I guess just that the promise of genetics is really exciting, and the next step is to do some really, really careful studies to understand the implications of the new tool that we have is understanding human genetic variation. This is considered such a significant advance to be able to recognize the nucleotide variation, the deletions and duplications, that human genetic variation was Science Magazine's concept of the year for 2007. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot happening in the field right now, and it's going to require a lot of caution and really careful studying over the next few years to understand its significance.
Well, thank you once again for sharing your time with us.